Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for listening to Milk Street Radio. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, to get our recipes, to stream our television show, or to get our latest cookbooks. Here's this week's show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Today we discover the world of deep-sea fishing with Bryn Smith. He discusses his crazy and also dangerous days of commercial fishing and the future of sustainable underwater agriculture, which he thinks is all about seaweed.
The ocean is so unique, and that when you ask it, what should we grow, it gives you such a simple answer, which is, why don't you grow things that don't swim away and you don't have to feed? And that opens up a whole realm of, what does agriculture look like underwater?
Also coming up, we make delicious maple whiskey pudding cakes, and Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett teach us the hidden food words found in flower names. But first, it's my interview with Anna Roche. She's the chef owner of Hiša Franko, located in the Soča Valley of Slovenia. Her book is called Sun and Rain. Anna, welcome to Milk Street.
Well, thank you.
Let's start with your valley. I've seen photographs of it in Slovenia, near Italy. It almost looks too good to be true. So do you want to just describe it? Because it is pretty spectacular.
It is even more spectacular, especially today when the sun is shining and there is blue sky. The rivers have that spectacular turquoise color. And there is a lot of mountains and very dense forest. It's one of the greenest areas on the world, really, but it's also facing the Mediterranean Sea. So we have a little bit everything what is on a wish list of people, usually.
So you used to go to the restaurant you now run as a kid. You say there's an hour drive up a winding mountain road. One of the specialties was English roast beef. And you used to drink Fanta soda when you were there. So what was the place like then in terms of the food and the experience?
Believe me or not, Hisha Franco at that time was one of the first private restaurants in Yugoslavia. And when I was a kid, we were making lines to eat roast beef and shtrukli. That was something you absolutely had to eat. I will never forget. I was so nervous when we got inside. And Franco, the old Franco, looked such an important man that I always split my drinks over the table. And when he saw us coming in, he was always, ah, there she is again. And plum, my soda went over the whole table. And it was a kind of like a nervousness because I felt that place so imposing and so important. You know, in that time, there was not a lot of dining out. I mean, the era of communism did some damage to the culture of the table.
So you take over the restaurant with no real culinary training, and you say that things were pretty tough the first few years when you were running the kitchen. You lost a lot of regular customers. So what kind of food were you trying to do? And then what kind of food did you finally end up doing?
Well, before going to the kitchen, I was actually helping managing the place for some years. And, you know, that was the time before investments, before credit. And we could afford, like, saying, for the weekend, let's go to Barcelona to eat at El Bulli. Or let's fly to London to go to Fed Duck and so on. So I had some kilometers in seeing that there is a lot going on in the gastronomy business. So when I took over the kitchen, the first thing I actually had to find out how to guarantee myself the freshest possible product. And of course, like, suppliers wouldn't be coming to the Socha Valley because it's a kind of really remote place. So this is how we were going and knocking on the doors of locals and trying to persuade them to share their products with us. But I always say that the most important thing I can hear from clients is, wow, through your food, we understand your environment. Through your food, we understand your products and even your farmers.
Let's talk about your food. Someone who dined there said you were serving tripe, and you said to him, this dish is kind of a risk. And then his description was great. It says, rich, unctuous, salty, funky, confusing. The soft, noodly tripe was napped with a walloping of cheese. Eating it was like being punched on the nose. And you've also said that the food for some people, you look at it and go, you know, I don't know if I want to eat it. And then you start eating it and it's just fabulous. So could you just describe that particular dish? Because I know you serve tripe a lot.
So, you know, when you cook a tripe, you know how the kitchen smells? You can't miss it. Especially, like, you know, we are talking about like local cows and so on. So, I mean, nothing is industrialized. So, yeah, the tripes are cleaned and so on, but you still have this wild animal flavor. So often people said to me, I'm so sorry, ma'am, but could we maybe change a tripe? And I was like, let's do something. Because I hate badly prepared tripes. And because of my school experience with tripes, I actually avoided them my whole life. But then one day I went to an Italian restaurant in Dolomites, and she prepared tripes and I ate them and I thought that I've never had anything better. So I think in our life we have to know how to challenge ourselves by approaching things that we sometimes think we hate, and this can turn into a big love.
Seems like a comment that goes way beyond the table. So you had the president of Slovenia show up at your restaurant, and he requested pasta with tomato sauce. What happened?
Well, I think it was 2016 or 17, and we got a call from a cabinet of the president asking for a table, but we've been booked out. So we emptied one table, we put some people at a fireplace to dine there. And then the president came, and then he refused to eat my menu, and he asked for pasta with tomato sauce and a salad. And so I first refused, and I was really, really bitter and angry. And I said, like, no way, really, no way. I mean, I understand diplomacy, and I understand that you somehow sometimes have to compromise. So, and then, of course, it's still a president. So I went to our storage room and took the tomato sauce that my father does for the restaurant in Istria from Istrian tomatoes that are probably, my God, the best tomatoes in the world. So I went to the other dry storage room and I found, like, I think it was the Cecco pasta for staff meal. So that was the only pasta I could get. And then I went to the garden to pick. We actually didn't have a salad. So I picked, you know, whatever I found, one carrot, one cucumber or whatever. And like I somehow created that meal. So he said, can I see a chef? And then I, of course, because I'm stubborn, I first said, no, I'm not going to go out for a pasta with tomato sauce. So then, of course, you know, the president is the president. So I went out and then, he complimented me. So, like a few days later, I got the call from the cabinet of the president telling me that the president would like to award me with a golden apple, which is an award that is given to special people in Slovenia. But this is fun because Hishatranko is today a place to go. It's a famous place. So a lot of people try to make a reservation and go because it's on their bucket list. But on the other side, like with Slovenians, we have sometimes a feeling like, you know, they have troubles to understand what we are doing. And I often said, like, I would really like my clients to understand our work because there is so much work in it.
So, Anna, is there something you're looking forward to doing in the next few years you haven't done yet?
I think I would like to learn how to enjoy life more. I did so many things. I've seen so many beautiful things, but I also worked so hard. I'm trying to take 2 days off for myself, and I see that this is really a treat because I really believe that if you treat yourself, your creativity is even stronger. And if you ask me where I want to travel, I don't know. I think I would like to climb on the highest mountain. Can I say something like that?
You sure? I think, you know what? I'll let you do that for me.
Well, let's do it together. I'm inviting you. But you should start training tomorrow because that's going to be a challenge soon.
I'll write that down in my to-do list. Train with Anna to climb Mount Everest. Anna, it's been just a great pleasure to have you here on Milk Street. Thank you so much. And best of, well, I don't think you need luck, but all the best for the future.
My God, I need a lot of luck. Wish me luck. That's good. Okay. And I wish you good luck as well.
Thank you.
Yes.
That was Anna Rosh. Her book is called Sun and Rain. Right now, my co-host Sarah Moult and I will be answering your cooking questions. Sarah is, of course, the author of Home Cooking 101, also star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals on public television.
Okay, before we take any questions, I have one for you, Chris.
Okay.
It's not culinary, so it's a little bit off, but I think interesting.
Not what I did in the 60s, okay?
No, I already know about that way too much. No, here's a question. So do you have a show that you like to watch that's just sort of an oddball show, that's not a cooking show, that nobody would have expected? A TV show, a Netflix show, one of those, or an old-fashioned, you know, thing?
I find myself drawn to black and white movies. I don't watch any current series right now. I'm currently watching The 39 Steps, Alfred Hitchcock's movie. I think it was his first movie. And it's almost like it was made in the 17th century, the way it's done, you know?
Yeah.
I would say old black and white movies are my favorites.
Oh, okay.
Okay, with that in mind, let's take a call.
Let's take a call.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Chris Martin from West Liberty, Iowa.
How can we help you?
My 14-year-old son loves margarita pizza. So I've been working for probably the last year on trying to perfect this pizza, which seems like it should be really easy. I've got the dough down, I've got the sauce down, I've got a fresh basil plant. But the problem comes when I get the mozzarella, I get the larger kind of pieces and then I slice them. Mm-hmm. But when I cook it at about 500 degrees, like it releases all the liquid from the mozzarella. So it just has this kind of milky substance. And I'm just trying to figure out, can I press it like I would tofu? Like, what could I do?
Well, I have an answer for you that I finally came to, which you're not going to like, but let me tell you a story before I get there. Years ago, I was in Naples at one of the well-known pizzerias, and they had three kinds of pizzas. That's it. And one of them was margherita. Uh-huh. And they used the fresh buffalo mozzarella. And everybody in the joint was eating with a knife and fork, which I thought was a bit odd until I got my pizza, because it turns out there was so much liquid in the cheese that the center of the pizza was soggy.
Oh.
The taste is great, but it basically ruins the crust. So recently I was developing a recipe for a pour-in-the-pan pizza. It's a very high hydration pizza, very, very loose dough. And I tried using fresh mozzarella, and it was a disaster. And so finally, and here's the answer you're not going to like, I now buy the really bad pre-shredded in the bag mozzarella. And it works like a charm because it's not wet. It's very dry. It melts nicely. And with everything else on the pizza, it's not like I'm really tasting the cheese. So it solves the problem. It's indelicate and an everyday solution. But as far as I know, there's really nothing you can do because that cheese has so much liquid in it in the high heat. The one answer, which is the expensive solution, is to go out and buy one of those gas-powered outdoor pizza ovens. They cost a few $100, rock box.
Oh, yeah.
I got one of those a few months ago. It gets up to 900 degrees. I cooked a pizza in 90 seconds. It was just amazing. And that'll take care of the problem. You're not going to get a soggy bottom crust, and the top will be fine. But if you're just using an oven, I just go buy the stuff in the bag and be done with it. Sarah, am I now off the show?
No. Actually, I was going to say, if you want to avoid that problem, you need to get the pre-shredded stuff because it's tossed with cornstarch also. Yeah. The trouble with the fresh stuff is it's like very high in water. I mean, you could try slicing it very thin and patting it dry, weighing it down and patting it dry between paper towels. But I think you are going to come up with the same problem over and over again.
Absolutely.
So for a rare instance, I agree with Chris. You know, the funny thing is his recipe starts with, number one, buy fancy new pizza oven for outside, you know.
Well, no, I said that would solve your problem. I just got to tell you, though, I know it's a ridiculous thing to buy. It's stupid. But it is amazing. You can cook pizza in under 2 minutes, and it is as good as what you'd get anywhere. So,
wow.
If you have a trust fund and you haven't taken money out of it lately, go get a pizza oven, you know, whatever. Or spend $2 on a bag of mozzarella.
Yeah,
there you go. Yeah. Chris, thanks.
Yes.
Thanks
you, Chris.
So much.
All right.
Take care.
Yep. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. Please give us a ring anytime with your questions or mysteries. 855-426-9843. One more time, 855-426-9843, or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hey, Chris. Hi, Sarah. This is Rob calling from Dakar, Senegal.
Dakar. I was there 18 months ago.
Wow.
Amazing place. That indoor market is just absolutely the most amazing place in the world.
We've driven by it. It looks amazing, but we have not been inside due to COVID, which sucks.
Oh. Yeah.
I saw your show on that. It looked great. Made several recipes from it, and they've all turned out fantastic.
So how can we help you?
I was reading a recipe from a pretty famous chef that called for chives. My first thought here was, where am I going to find chives? And then I just thought about it for a little bit, and I thought, well, I'll just use green onions. I kept on thinking about it, and I honestly couldn't think of a reason to buy chives really ever again. Like, pretty much every recipe I could think of would just call for using green onions instead of chives, and they just seem so similar, but green onions are so much more versatile. And I guess my quick question to you both as very famous chefs, if either of you had a recipe on hand that called for chives, but you had green onions, would you actually go out and buy chives?
Well, I think the reason to buy chives is to support your local supermarket to make sure they're still in business a year from now, because it costs $3 for like this tiny little package. It's just ridiculous. I can think of a case, Sarah, you probably agree with me. If I was going to scramble eggs, I wouldn't put chopped scallions in it. A little bit of chive is more subtle and would go better, but 99% of the time, you know, scallions, green onions are fine. I think chives are a little fresher tasting, a little sharper tasting. But you're right. Well, there's very few times when you couldn't substitute scallions for chives.
I agree. If it's just really a garnish, go ahead and go for the scallions. The only thing about chives is they're so pretty. They're more tender than thin sliced scallions. So there's that to be said for them too. And I would also say they're pretty easy to grow.
Pretty much every single time I have bought chives, I use a tiny little bit of them. It's just for like a topping of a potato or something like that. And then the rest just go bad in our fridge. But like with green onions, I'll just go through them like crazy. I buy them every week. So it's like for just a home cook, I just cannot think of a reason besides supporting the grocery store.
Well, scallions, I buy them every week too. A couple bunches. I put them on almost everything. They're sort of like onions for me. I think of scallions as sort of grown up, tough, less piquant chives.
I'd say more for garnish purposes are chives, not that they have no flavor, but, you know, Rob, you're right. You throw out the rest of them. It's a waste.
All the best, Robert. Hope to get to the market, and don't worry about chives.
Yeah, all right. I agree.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you both very
Pleasure.
Much, and I look forward to the radio show every week.
Thanks.
So take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Up next, we'll hear from Brent Smith. He's author of Eat Like a Fish. That and more after the break. I'm Christopher Kimball, and now here's a word from our friends at Allagash Brewing Company, who love food as much as we do here at Milk Street.
Hi, this is Jason Perkins. I'm the brewmaster at Allagash, and I've been making Allagash White in Portland, Maine since 1999. So a white beer is a very old style of beer. Traditionally, it was brewed with spices of some type, typically coriander and orange peel. And I think one of the things that makes Allagash White distinctive and different is the rare combination of complexity and drinkability. And it's sometimes remarkable to stop and realize that I never get tired of it. You know, I'll open a can or I'll pour a glass and the first sip and I'm like, man, this beer is good. There are a lot of different ways that folks can enjoy an Allagash White, and here are some of the examples of what folks here at the brewery like to do.
My favorite thing to pair with an Allagash White is simple, beautiful seared scallops over a bed of fresh greens with blood orange and shaved fennel.
My favorite would probably have to be like an Italian or a hoagie, capicola, pickled vegetables, crusty bread. It's got that nice lemony, zesty character that just gets you ready for the next bite.
The ultimate pairing for me is this dish called bosam, which is this like big pork shoulder with like salt and brown sugar. We also call it candy pork in my house, and a little like scallion ginger sauce. It's like lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, lettuce, rice, pork, sip of white, and it's just perfection.
My other top choice was like a hot dog. Like just have a hot dog and have an Allagash White. You don't need to dress it up.
There's something about mussels with beer, especially the white, that is just so good.
I feel like it goes really well with different soft cheeses that aren't too dominant, but then also with like spicy Indian food. So I think it's just really versatile.
I could imagine like something like lemon meringue pie. That would be really nice.
Pairing Allagash White with carrot cake is a thing of beauty.
This maybe it sounds really boring, but pepperoni pizza. I feel like after a long week, having like a nice warm pepperoni pizza and a cold Allagash White is just like you made it. Like you did your week. You deserve this pizza. You deserve this beer.
It's perfect in summer. It's perfect in winter.
I haven't really found a flavor that I don't think works really well with Allagash White.
Yeah, so not only do I drink it while I cook, I often cook with it. So if I'm creating some kind of stew, I'll add a little bit of Allagash White to it.
A lot of people use Allagash White in like a fried fish batter.
Anywhere where you can add like a spritz of lemon or a spritz of lime, that could be the beer.
We are very food-minded here at Allagash, obviously. And I think because of that, Allagash White is kind of subtle in a way that not all beers are, and I think that makes it very food-friendly.
I think it tends to unlock qualities in the food that you otherwise wouldn't necessarily notice.
Like, it's not too hoppy or it's not too sweet, so it sits right in the middle and sort of brings the flavors of the dish to life.
If you ask anyone here at Allagash, we're pretty much all stands for this beer. We love it so much because every time you have it, you pick up something new.
Every time you come back to it, you're reminded, like, oh, wow, yeah, that's really good.
This is Jason Perkins again. Just wanted to say thanks to everyone at Allagash for sharing. You can try Allagash White at home, too. Head to allagash.com/locator to find Allagash White near you.
For 21 plus only, please drink responsibly. Allagash Brewing Company, Portland, Maine.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's my interview with Bryn Smith. His memoir, Eat Like a Fish, recounts his career shift from commercial fisherman to restorative ocean farmer. Bryn, welcome to Milk Street.
Thanks. It's an honor to be on.
I have to say, Eat Like a Fish, your memoir, sort of is Restaurant Confidential, you know, of the sea. and the stories are better because, you know, Restaurant Kitchen is more familiar to most people than a fishing boat, which is a lot more dangerous and a lot more interesting. So I love the book. You write, "I crawl out of bed like a lobster most mornings. I've lost vision in half my right eye from a chemical splash in Alaska. I'm an epileptic who can't swim, and I'm allergic to shellfish." You seem like a somewhat unlikely candidate to end up doing what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this definitely wasn't the plan, right? And I mean, in some ways, I miss my old life. You know, I miss the high seas. I'm a hunter and I love to chase and kill things. That's my roots. And I never thought I'd be like, you know, growing arugula underwater and drinking tea, right? That just wasn't the plan. And I always say, like, I can't go to the same bars I used to go to. I get beat up, you know?
And your home life was interesting. You said your dad set up a work release program, recruiting Inuit parolees from the local jail to become graduate assistants for the Inuit dictionary he was working on. So you didn't have the typical suburban upbringing.
No, I mean, I was a mixed up kid. You know, my parents were from the U.S., went up during the Vietnam War, but raised me in the, you know, most eastern point in all of North America, you know, a really remote little fishing village in Newfoundland. And so I was always pulled between those two. My dad was a linguist and one of those sort of wild academics from the 60s that was allowed to kind of do anything, I think, and call it research. But I was just drawn to the sea, and I was drawn to my neighbors, you know, which were fishermen. And, you know, I've often thought back, like, why was I so drawn? I mean, sure, it was the culture I grew up in, but that just sense of meaning of feeding your country, the sort of self-direction that a fisherman has, succeeding, failing on your own terms, like that's the soul of a fisherman. And as we say, you know, these are jobs you can write and sing songs about. Like, no one's writing good songs about lawyers. They write them about farmers, fishermen, coal workers, steel workers, right? People who power, build, and feed the country. And I wanted to be one of those, right? And so That was the journey I embarked on.
I never thought about that. Maybe Bob Dylan should have written a song about lawyers, you know? I don't think it would have gone over too well. You lived off condiment sandwiches, Wonder Bread with ketchup, mustard, and relish packets, and sugar lifted from gas stations and fast food joints. So your early menu was, at that time, was a little limited.
Well, and, you know, I am not, right from the start, and for good or bad, right to today, I'm not a foodie. Like, I'm not moved by taste. Food is a very functional thing for me. You know, I love the fish sandwich at McDonald's. I'm happy to eat at the gas station. Like, food has this other role in my life. And I love feeding people, but I'm not attracted to flavor much.
Let's talk about your time fishing. You talk about danger. It's obviously a very dangerous profession. And you said that the fishermen you're with didn't even try to escape the danger. It was sort of part of the gestalt of that profession. Could you explain that? Because I didn't quite understand that.
Yeah, I think it is hard to explain. There's something about the identity and the culture. I mean, no one It's changed now some, I think. You know, on Deadliest Catch in Alaska, I see people wearing life vests, right? Well, back in the 80s, 90s, when I was on the boats, no one wore life vests, and I still don't. And in my head, it's like, oh, I'm not as mobile. I can't work as fast and be as agile. There, you're just surrounded constantly by, you know, cranes and moving big crab cages and wild weather. But, you know, I don't want to defend the culture. It just is. Yeah.
So 40,000 hooks, you know, miles of line. You have to set it right. You have to untangle it. So what are a couple of things that can go really badly wrong with all of this?
Yeah. So getting a hook in your hand. So, you know, when the hooks come into the boat and then they're going through these collars and the hooks are spinning. And if you grab the line wrong, you'll get, I've actually have scars in my hand where I've been hooked real bad. And if it hooks in and grabs the bone, right, then you're in real trouble because you're just, you know, the gear doesn't stop. The other thing's a really simple issue is when you're setting gear, if the coils are upside down, it's a huge issue. So someone's coiled and set it the wrong way and you lift that coil up. And it's on your forearm and you're about to throw it off and it gets pulled from the wrong side. So it gets pulled from your elbow. It'll flip your arm out and drag you over the side of the boat, over the gunwale. And then just this, everything is moving. So like your floor is moving, your cranes are moving, your cages are moving in a different direction. And every day is different weather and just all that motion and things break, you know, all the time. So there's an awareness that, just understanding you're never going to beat the sea and you just have to be as cautious and humble as possible.
But underneath all of this, and you allude to this in the book, there's a meaning to that work which you don't find in the rest of modern life. I mean, you clearly feel, and I agree with you, that modern life at its base, at its foundation, is lacking some sort of urgency and meaning, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, being in the belly of a boat with 13 people for months at a time, working those 30-hour shifts, there's just nothing like it. I mean, that sense of solidarity and that just purpose of just going out catching as many fish as you can, and you're doing good. You're feeding folks. I mean, most of the fish I was catching was going to McDonald's when I was working in the Bering Sea, but that was okay. Like, that, you know, we were feeding the masses. And so it wasn't like working day and night in a hedge fund. It was doing 100-hour weeks to feed folks.
You got disabused of especially salmon farming. You talk about, you said, shoveled hundreds of pounds of dank smelling pellets, ground from the meat of the distant wild cousins of these imprisoned mutants. So you were not real happy with sort of the commercial fish farming business, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I came out of the industrial fishery and then the cod stocks crashed and I was sold aquaculture. It was supposed to be the great answer of overfishing and transition for those of us that have been on the boats. But what aquaculture did, it took all the mistakes of sort of industrial pig farming on land and just move them out to sea. So instead of asking the ocean what to grow, like what does it make sense? What's unique about the ocean as an agricultural space? It just grew salmon and tuna, but those were wild palate tastes, right? And markets. And the ocean is so unique and that when you ask it, what should we grow? It gives you such a simple answer, which is why don't you grow things that don't swim away and you don't have to feed? And that opens up a whole realm of what does agriculture look like underwater?
Well, let's get to that topic. So you have come up with a pretty interesting sort of vertical growing concept. So what is the concept of your underwater farm?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that I'm part of a long, long, long tradition. Like going back thousands of years, the indigenous communities were building clam walls to capture clams. An Irishman was shipwrecked in France and tried to net some ducks. He put out nets and they got filled with mussel seed. So then he decided to become a mussel farmer. And that was the beginning of mussel farming. Like, I'm part of this long tradition. I think what I did was I took all these different techniques, brought them together in one system and kept them simple, but I think powerful as a way to grow food. So what it looks like, think of it as an underwater scaffolding system. So our kelp, rather than growing from the bottom up, it grows from these lines up near the surface vertically downwards. And then we can use these same lines to grow mussels and mussel socks, which just look like kind of big sausages, and then scallops and lantern nets, and then I grow oysters down in the bottom in cages, and then clams down in the mud. And this just allows us to really take that polyculture approach, grow as many species as possible in 20 acres, have a small footprint because we're vertical, and have a low aesthetic impact because everything's underwater.
So this is like land agriculture transferred to the ocean, right?
Yep. Taking all those lessons, like just not making the same mistakes. And these are all zero input foods. And I think this is so important. Like they take no fresh water, no feed, no fertilizer, unlike any other crop or animal on land. It's zero input food, making it the most sustainable and regenerative food on the planet.
Also, I was shocked about the amount of production. You said per acre, up to 150,000 shellfish and 10 tons of seaweed. I mean, it's highly productive.
Yeah. It just, there is, you know, when you mimic Mother Nature with biodiversity, it just takes off. And and the key from, I mean, you know, regenerative ocean farming is great, but it's also, we have to make money, right? This is about jobs. This is about making a living on a living planet. So the idea is to grow what makes sense as a farmer and then get chefs and home cooks and everything as creative as possible and creating this new, what I think of as climate cuisine. And that's their burden. Like if a chef can't make what I grow delicious, I think maybe they should quit their profession. Like they're here on Earth now to create a climate cuisine, take what right. The Earth can provide and turn it into beautiful, delicious food. And I think they can do it.
Let's talk about the food. You said your team prepares kelp linguine, kelp ice cream, kelp cocktails. So what are some of the things you guys are playing around with in terms of how to use what you're farming?
Yeah, so I mean, I made a mistake when I first started harvesting kelp. I gave it to the folks who were buying my oysters, and they had no idea what to do with it, meaning they're like, yeah, we'll did it, and they cook with it, and they just wrap it around fish or turn it into a seaweed salad. And that just wasn't working. And then I discovered sort of the chefs that specialize in vegetables, right? And they were immediately just saw it as a green, right? A baby leaf kelp or a kelp noodle. And you find someone like Brooks Headley and their recipes in the book from him, where I gave it to him and he did barbecue kelp noodles with parsnips and breadcrumbs, right? So just amazing. And think of it as a whole leaf strategy, just like a whole animal strategy. Take this year. I just finished harvest last week. So the first third went to specialty products, plant-based. And then the next section of the plant went to land-based regenerative farmers who used it to feed sheep, chicken, and fertilizer and compost, something that land-based farmers have been doing forever, like, you know, 150, 200 years. And then the last part of the plant, the waste, went to make compostable seaweed straws and packaging. So that's what gives me hope, right? That whole leaf strategy, because changing food tastes is slow, right? And we have, 10 years to really turn this economy around so we can work to change tastes while we're also weaving our crops into all these different industries.
You know, you write in the book about a particular bar, which was, I guess, the toughest bar in the world. What was the name of the bar and where was it again? I don't remember.
That was the Elbow Room up in Dutch in Alaska.
And, you know, you were good in a knife fight and et cetera. And now, as you said, you're drinking tea. You are a politician of sorts. You're a farmer. You're a long way from that. And you've also said that you're a hunter, right? I mean, that's what fishing is, I guess. How do you reconcile your current more, you know, it's like being a hunter-gatherer and then all of a sudden putting up a fence and raising crops. That's a very different thing from your soul, right? So is this where you always wanted to be, or do you really kind of want to get back on a boat in the Bering Sea once in a while?
So transition for all of us, whether you're a coal miner or a farmer or a fisherman, like we're going to have to transition into new kinds of occupations, right, that are deindustrialized. But it is, we just have to acknowledge it's going to be heartbreaking. I mean, that, like, I love to chase things, right? That thrill, that adrenaline, the humility of being in the high seas. Now I'm on Long Island Sound, and, like, the most exciting thing that happens is, like, a rogue wave of 2.5 feet, right? I mean, it's like, what? That's no fun at all. But let's look into the soul of a fisherman. A fisherman is what I knew as a kid, a self-directed life, no boss, succeeding and failing on your own terms, which is really about agency, right? Having your own direction and feeding the country. So we still get to keep those as farmers, right? We still get to retain those. We have to say goodbye to parts of our souls, but I think there's still jobs we can write and sing songs about. That's how I feel.
Brent, it's been just a remarkable pleasure having you on Milk Street. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Complete honor. It's just amazing what you all have built. So thank you for that.
That was Brent Smith. His memoir is called Eat Like a Fish, My Adventures as a Fisherman Turned Restorative Ocean Farmer. The first large-scale commercial fishing boat may have been the Herring Bus. Now, this was a 60-foot-long, 100-ton broadbeam ship. They used drifting gill nets to catch herring. The fleets consisted of up to 500 ships and would stay at sea for many weeks at a time. Special cargo ships transferred the catch back to port while the Herring Bus fleet stayed at sea. Manned by Dutch sailors, the fleets were accompanied by naval ships since they often fished in English waters and were therefore considered poachers. Today, we bemoan the declining stocks of wild fish due to overfishing, but of course, this is nothing new. A fleet of 500 fishing boats put a pretty good dent in the stocks of wild herring. My point is simple. Nothing much has changed except technology. Human instinct is driven by profit, not sustainability. So enter Brent Smith. If he and others can make sustainable aquaculture profitable, then human instinct and our future may finally align. It's time to chat with Catherine Smart about this week's recipe, maple whiskey pudding cakes. Catherine, how are you?
I'm good, Chris. How are you?
You know, back in the early 1970s, Marion Cunningham, she was a famous cookbook author, used to work with Jim Beard, redid the Fanny Farmer books. And one of the recipes I love from that book are pudding cakes. These are old-fashioned recipe. They're magic. You take a cake batter and you take a very thin sauce. You put the cake batter in your container, ramekin, whatever. Pour this thin sauce on top, which looks like it's never going to work. Throw it in the oven, it comes out, the sauce has dropped to the bottom of the ramekin, the cake batter has risen to the top, so you have cake on the top, and at the bottom you have a sauce which is now thick. So it changed places and it also thickens, so you get a cake with sauce in the same ramekin or souffle dish. So it's a little magic, and so this is a maple whiskey pudding cake, which is, I think, a lot more interesting than standard lemon or chocolate. So how do we get started?
First of all, this cake eats like a warm hug. They were making it in the kitchen the other day, and I stole an entire whiskey cake that I was supposed to just have one bite of. So just a little confessional to start off. And yes, Chris, it is very impressive, and it's a little bit of magic, but it couldn't be more simple. To start, we actually make the sauce. That's what you do first. And it really is like a brown butter sauce with whiskey and maple syrup and butter. But we actually add a little bit of apple cider vinegar. And that is a nice trick for kind of balancing out the sweetness and cutting through so it doesn't get too cloying. Then you're going to whip together the simplest cake batter. You actually do it in a food processor. And it's just your standard all-purpose flour with some leavener and egg. And you do add a little bit of toasted pecan, which adds both texture and flavor. You put the batter in your oiled ramekins and pour over the sauce, and then it goes right into the oven.
These are individual servings. You can make it in a bigger dish, but we'd like to serve them individually.
Individual is best. And then you can, of course, hoard one for the cook either before or after your guests arrive.
It sounds like you don't hoard them. It sounds like you just eat one as soon as it comes out.
Shameless, Chris.
You're absolutely shameless. So maple whiskey and pudding cake, it's a little bit of magic. The sauce starts out on top, ends up at the bottom. You get cake and a sauce, and you get individual servings. Catherine, thank you.
Thanks, Chris. You can get this recipe for maple whiskey pudding cake at 177milkstreet.com.
This is Milk Street Radio. Coming up, Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett give us a language lesson on edible flowers. We'll be right back. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, this is Chris Kimball, and I need your help. We're working on a story about the battles we all have in our home kitchens. Maybe you're tired of your partner telling you how to cook, or maybe they always leave a mess, or maybe you're frustrated by your loved one's highly restrictive diet. We want to hear about your kitchen dramas, from the biggest food fights to your everyday grievances. You can leave us a voicemail at 617-249-3167, 617-249-3167, or send a voice memo to radiotips@177milkstreet.com. One more time, call us at 617-249-3167 or email us a voice memo at radiotips@177milkstreet.com. Please include your name and where you're calling from, and thank you. I'm Christopher Kimball. You're listening to Milk Street Radio. Right now, Sarah Molt and I will be answering a few more of your cooking questions.
Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Beth calling from Burlington, Vermont.
Oh, Chris territory.
Yeah.
How can we help you today?
Well, I had a question about goat cheese. I recently bought some goat cheese, and I brought it home. I had bought it at a specialty cheese store. It was a little bit more expensive than I usually pay for goat cheese. The next day I opened it, and it looked like it had gray mold all over it. And so I thought it was rancid, and I threw it out. And afterwards, I looked at the packaging, and the ingredients said that it was treated with ash. I had never heard of that before, and so my question is, do you just scrape off the ash, and why is it treated with ash?
Well, the ash is a French thing. Originally, it started in France, that the ash was like a protection for the cheese, and it's just made from charred vegetable matter. It could have been the grapevines, even, that they would burn up and put on top, because they thought that it helped to keep insects and other contaminants away. But then later on, they also realized that it was an acid retardant. And acid is not good for goat cheese. It doesn't develop the same kind of flavor. So this was a good thing to have on the outside. And it's basically flavorless. So it's completely edible. I could see, of course, why you thought that. It looks like mold. But unfortunately, no, it was perfectly fine cheese.
You know, I had never seen anything like that on goat cheese before. You know, it's from a small farm, so it was sort of high-end goat cheese. When I opened it, I just was kind of shocked because I thought maybe it had just gone bad. And afterwards, I wasn't sure if I'm just supposed to scrape it off
or if it
was edible.
Just eat it. Chris, do you want to
weigh
in here?
Well, I have a few non-food things to say. First of all, you sound like my neighbors in Vermont, which you'd be like, why is there this stuff on the outside of my cheese? Which I just think is great. And the other thing I really love is you call a national radio show to say that you bought this goat cheese and threw it out because it had funny stuff on the outside. So, and that's also very Vermont.
I probably should have looked at the packaging before I threw it out because I might have tried it.
The rest of us do this very quietly, never tell anybody.
Right.
Well, now I'm going to try it. I'm going to go back and buy it because I'm sure it was delicious.
I'm sure it was, too. All right, Beth, thank you.
Thanks, Beth.
All right, thank you.
Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. Please give us a call anytime if you have a question. The number is 855-426-9843. One more time. 855-426-9843, or email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
This is Diane.
How are you? Where are you calling from?
I am calling from as far west in Canada as you can get, Victoria, British Columbia.
How can we help you?
Okay, my question was about using buttermilk as a substitute for regular milk, because I often have buttermilk and it keeps longer, and I often have canned milk, but I never have regular milk, so I didn't know how it would use as a substitute.
You could use it as a substitute. Just add, if there's leavening in the recipe, it's baking, for example, just add some baking soda. Use half as much baking soda as the baking powder that's called for in the recipe. So if it's a teaspoon of baking powder, add half a teaspoon of baking soda, because you have to balance the acidity of the buttermilk with the baking soda, which is alkaline. So that's just a little formula you can use to fix anything where there's leavening issues. I don't think there'd be any other problem, right, Sarah?
No, but my question was, where did you want to use the buttermilk? Like, in what kind of recipes?
I pretty well use it anywhere you can use milk.
Wow, now that's interesting. I think that's great. Most buttermilk is lean. I imagine you're using the regular supermarket brand?
I use the supermarket, but it's the old-fashioned 3.5%.
All right, so it has a higher butterfat content, but even so, it still doesn't have enough butterfat that you could actually boil it, and it sounds like you're not doing that anyway. You're just adding it wherever you would have added milk, correct?
Exactly.
I think that's brilliant. I like this idea.
There are times, though, if dairy's too lean and it gets heated in a soup, right, Sarah? That could be problematic because the more fat you have in a dairy product, the less likely it is to break.
Oh. Right, but if she doesn't heat it up too high, it's not going to break. Yeah. And it sounds like she's not doing that.
I didn't know that.
If you brought something to a boil with a lean dairy product, it's more likely to break than if you had like heavy cream or half and half.
Well, even half and half might
split. Yeah, that might break, but cream won't. Because it's got enough fat. But if
Creme fraiche, although sour cream will. It's very baffling. Yeah. Mm. But it sounds like you haven't gotten into trouble that way, so maybe we shouldn't go there.
I get into trouble other ways.
Well, let's talk about that. Come on. Forget about buttermilk.
I think I'll take the fifth.
All right. Well, thank you for your question. And I think that it's good to know how to use up leftover buttermilk for all the other people listening, because that's an issue for everybody. And you've just given them some new ideas.
Okay, well, that is great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Milk Street Radio. Now it's time for this week's cooking tip from one of our listeners.
Hi, my name is Judy. Everyone loves my tomato sauce, and I found my secret ingredient in a silly novel I was reading. The head mafioso was saying to his cook that he was disgusted that the man can never make sauce as good as his mama's. In walks some of his soldiers holding a gagged man who is in big trouble with the mob. He's about to get killed when he professes that he can make sauce as good as the boss's mom. And he does. It saves his life. Along with onion, garlic, red pepper flakes, red wine, and tomatoes, the man adds ground fennel, and magic happens. Sauce as good as mama's. I added ground fennel to my next batch of tomato sauce, and it was wonderful. Now I never make sauce without it. Never know where you'll find wisdom. Enjoy.
If you'd like to share your own culinary hack or secret ingredient on Milk Street Radio, please go to 177milkstreet.com/radiotips. Next up, it's Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, hosts of Away With Words. Grant, Martha, how are you?
We're doing great.
Fantastic.
What's on the menu for this week?
Eating flowers.
Just munching on petals right and left, out of the yard, head down in the grass.
Well, yeah, we eat edible flowers all the time in the form of broccoli and cauliflower, but there are a lot of other ones that can spice up a dish or add color to your plate. You know, the ancient Romans had a recipe for baked brains and roses, which I'm not eager to try, but, you know, it's sort of like a little liver pate or something with rose petals on top. And the Victorians served pansies in gelatin. But there are lots of edible blossoms that have really picturesque etymologies. And one of my favorites is nasturtium. Do you ever eat nasturtium, Chris?
No, I've seen recipes calling for it, but I've never had it.
Yeah, you know, they have sort of a peppery taste. And the Roman historian Pliny said that the name nasturtium comes from Latin words that mean nose twister because of that peppery taste. And that would make it related etymologically to words like nasal and other nose words. And the last part of nasturtium may have to do with either the Latin word tormentum, which is related to torment, or twisting words like contort or distort or torque. And another cool thing about the word nasturtium is that the Italian word for it is cappuccina. Does that sound familiar?
Does have a slight familiar ring.
Yeah, if you look at the nasturtium blossom, one end of it kind of tapers like the hood of a Capuchin monk. And those monks also had very drab robes. And so early on, they named the coffee drink cappuccino after the drab color of those robes. So it's all connected, this big web of language.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
There are some varieties of nasturtiums in Peru that have edible tubers, but those typically aren't grown in North America. And they look like radishes. They look very tasty. I wonder what those would be like in a salad.
Yeah, I wonder if they're peppery.
And now, Martha, we have daisy, which comes from day's eye. It's just a corruption over time of standard English, right?
Correct, yes. Because some varieties of daisies open just in the daytime and then they close up at night. So it's the eye of the day.
Huh. Now, this is one that I know. Dandelion comes from the French dent de lion, which means lion's tooth because of the leaf shape.
Right.
That's the one I actually knew.
Oh, you did?
Right. But there's a couple other levels to this. One is that name is similar to the names in Italian, Portuguese, and German. They also have names in their languages that mean something like lion's tooth because of the shape. And there's a French name, which I'm going to let Martha say if she wants, has something to do with the diuretic effect of dandelions.
Pissenlit.
Which basically means wet the bed.
You have to be careful how you say that, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And then connecting these last two words, daisies and dandelions, the French equivalent of the English phrase pushing up daisies, which means to be buried in the ground when you're dead, is the French to eat dandelions by the root, manger le pissenlit par la racine, which you can find in Les Misérables. So pushing up daisies in French is to eat dandelions by the root. So there's
That's
just
even
these
better.
Interesting connections. Yeah.
Well, the French, as usual, when it comes to things like that, are very expressive.
Well, I'll give you one more flower that's really cool for adding color to a dish, and that's the pansy. I mentioned that the Victorians preserved them in gelatin, which would be just a beautiful little, you know, little cube of that as a treat. But the word pansy is really fabulous because it comes from the French word pensée, which you may know means thought. It's related to words like pensive. And in Hamlet, Ophelia says, "There's pansies. That's for thoughts." And the story about why pansies are called by this name may be that the French saw a little elfin face in those petals, because some varieties of pansies look like they have little faces. But the weird thing about that is that in German, the term for pansy is Stiefmutterchen, which means little bitty stepmother. And some people say that where the French saw a pensive little face on the flower, the Germans see a scowling stepmother. Now, I've told that story many times, but now that I'm a stepmother myself, I'm not sure I like it.
And that's all you need to know about the difference between the French and the Germans, right?
But honestly, I've seen some hilarious pictures of pansy flowers that look like they're really mad at you. I don't know if there's a Pinterest board with angry pansies or a Facebook group, but if there isn't, there should be, because some of them look really scary. I've seen one that looked like Darth Vader.
That, Who's been drinking the wine around
here? Martha. I'm busted.
Now, the Spanish also use the meaning thought for the pansy, the pensamiento. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I believe the Italians have it as well. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how far that story goes into the history of European culture mm-hmm. about the representing a thought or someone yeah. thinking.
Grand Martha, thank you very much. I will rush out and make a nasturtium jelly. And Martha, if I'm like you, I'll get my spoon and look into it and find Darth Vader. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care, Chris.
That was Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett, hosts of Away With Words. That's it for this week's show. If you tuned in too late or want to binge listen every single episode, you can download Milk Street Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. To learn more about Milk Street, visit us at 177milkstreet.com. There you can find all of our recipes, take a free online cooking class, or order our latest cookbook, Cookish. You can also find us on Facebook at Christopher Kimball's Milk Street, on Instagram and Twitter at 177milkstreet. We'll be back next week with more food stories, and thanks, as always, for listening.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producer, Melissa Baldino. Senior audio editor, Melissa Allison. Co-executive producer, Annie Sinsabaugh. Associate producer, Jackie Nowak. Production assistant, Sarah Clapp. And production help from Debbie Paddock. Senior audio engineer, David Goodman. Additional editing from Vicky Merrick, Sydney Lewis, and Samantha Brown. And audio mixing from Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Theme music by Chewbop Crew. Additional music by George Brendel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.